We estimate that child bedlessness represents greater than 3% of the given population anywhere.
Wow. So
if you're in a town of 100,000 people, on average anyways, there's 3,000 kids that don't have a bed to sleep in.
Are you raising a family while also feeling like you're still growing up yourself? Do you wonder if you are getting it right? Welcome to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah. She's a pediatrician and a mom, and she helps the whole family.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sarah Adams, a board-certified pediatrician, but I'm not your pediatrician. Feel free to use my podcast as helpful information, but in no way do I intend my podcast to replace the advice of your physician. Your physician knows you and is in the best position to provide medical advice. As a pediatrician, I spend a lot of time talking about sleep, how essential it is for a child's brain, body, and emotional health. But today's guest reminds us that far too many children, the challenge isn't getting enough sleep. It's having a safe place to sleep at all. Luke Mickelson is founder of Sleep in Heavenly Peace, a nonprofit born from a moment that stopped him cold. Discovering that children in his own hometown were sleeping on piles of clothes on the floor. I saw your episode on Mike Rose returning the favor, and it brought tears to my eyes. Welcome, Luke, to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah.
Oh, thanks, Doc. It's good to be on.
You described yourself as a farm kid whose small act of service grew into this global nonprofit. Can you take us back to the moment when you first realized that kids were sleeping on the floor and this was a problem you just couldn't ignore?
By the way, I'm still just a farm kid.
I love that.
You know, and well, what's kind of unique about that, being from a small town, you know, you're forced into things that you might not otherwise do. You know, for example, if you knew how to pick up a ball and throw it in any general direction with any sort of accuracy, you're going to play sports, whether you like it or not, you know?
I always say that because it
helped develop a bond I had with friends and local communities because everybody knew each other and whether you liked it or not, you know. And why that's critical is because when this ugly thing called child bedlessness reared its head, you know, it happened in a way that was really strange. Like, you know, from a small town, so I knew everywhere in this town. I'd been everywhere, or at least I thought I did. And at the time, I was serving in my church as what was called a young men's president. As that position required, I would sit in meetings in my church with other auxiliary leaders, and we'd talk about, you know, things that were going on in the congregation, in the small community, and people that we were helping. Well, they talked about a family that lived in an apartment complex I didn't even know existed, right?
Oh.
That's how kind of remote it was. And so it kind of caught my ear going, wait a minute, where's this place at? And, you know, the mom was the local school bus driver and the dad was, you know, he kind of suffered from some mental health issues. So he couldn't hold a job. You know, they were just struggling. Well, we were helping them with bills and rides to work at school or whatever. Well, it came up that the kids didn't have any beds.
Wow.
And I said, wait a minute, like, what, they got mattresses or something, right? And they said, no, they're just sleeping on the floor. That just, it just killed me. I just really, you know, just the thought of any kids, let alone even my own kids, I thought about sleeping on the floor. Okay, we got to stop that. And that's the first time I ever heard about child bedlessness.
Yeah, as a pediatrician, I'm really struck by how big these public health issues really start with something so simple as conversations in a church meeting.
Yeah.
What did you notice early on that others were overlooking?
Well, number one, I found out very quickly that no one knew about this.
Mm-hmm.
And later on in the stories, as I built more beds and shared what I was doing and building beds and providing it for kids and whatnot, I got funny phone calls or I'd go to meetings and there'd be someone from CASA. There'd be someone from Child Protective Services or foster care, you know. And, you know, Dr. Sarah, I was the most popular guy in the room for this purpose only, which is actually not very funny, but it was kind of
I know.
Because getting a bed for a child for these organizations that are dealing with homelessness or transitioning or whatever, you know, finding a bed for a child, if it wasn't the number one, it was the top three hardest things for these organizations to find, which kind of blew my mind. Really, like, you can get a stove or a TV or, you know, easier than you can get a child's bed. And we're actually partners with another organization called Care Portal, which is a service organization nationwide where people can, you know, ask for things and, you know, they help provide it if you're familiar with it. Well, their number one request is beds for kids.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. And these are kids that are experiencing housing insecurity, like foster care transitions and all kinds of crisis. And you learned this early on. And what was it that eventually led you to leave your career and make this your full-time job?
Oh, it's an easy one. It's when I did my very first delivery. You know, we built a bed for this family with my Boy Scouts, right? It was a great opportunity to get an Xbox controller out of their hands and put a drill in it, right?
I love that.
And finding an activity for teenage kids to do that doesn't involve a screen or an Xbox is not an easy thing to do.
No.
But they had a great time when we built this bed. Well, I wanted that same experience for my kids, right? I wanted them to feel the joy of service and giving back, as well as appreciate the things they had. So we built this other bed. And I didn't know what to do with it. At the time, I didn't know child bedlessness was a problem. I knew about the one family that we built the bed for and delivered with the Boy Scouts. But now I built this bed with my kids, and I had no idea what to do with it. So I went to the internet, I went to Facebook, and put it on one of those buy-sell trade groups, you know, and worried that I was going to get every Tom, Dick, and Harry wanting a free bed. But what happened was pretty interesting. Whether they were friends or complete strangers that saw the post, and it was a very simple post, you know, a Christmas project that my family, we built a bed, we want to give it to a child. You know, I started reading these posts from people about kids and the situations that they were sleeping in. That was my first taste of, you got to be kidding me. Like, kids are sleeping on cement floors and basements. They're sleeping on pallets and crates and couch cushions. I mean, just crazy things. And then when a friend of mine called and said, hey, I've got the perfect situation for you. I've got the kid that you want to deliver to. And it's my Haley story. Well, Haley was a 6-year-old girl, never slept on a bed, slept in the backseat of her mom's car.
Oh,
can you imagine? And
can't.
You know, I'm sure once in a while she couch dived at friends' house, but for the most part, her and her mom were homeless. Well, my friend helped them get, one of these houses, government-assisted houses, and they were no longer homeless. Yeah, it was awesome. But when I walked into this house, I mean, you can imagine, there was nothing. There was no couch or table or whatnot. There was a hot plate sitting on a milk crate that had a can of soup on it, and that was the only thing in the house. You know, it was just heartbreaking. And I'd seen poverty and seen homelessness and all this before. But I never really saw it through the eyes of a 6-year-old, you know, and that really does change your perspective a little bit. And you know, Haley, I said, hey, she was so excited. She finally had a bedroom. I was like, show me your bedroom. Well, she walked me back in this bedroom. And, you know, I didn't know what I was expecting, but I wasn't expecting what I saw. You know, you can imagine the carpet had holes in it and tears in the paper and all this stuff. But Sarah, the most shocking thing was what I saw in the corner. And that was her bed. And it was nothing more than a nest of clothes.
Oh.
He slept on her school clothes. And at first, you know, you almost get mad. I was almost pissed.
Right.
Not in my town. And then it went to happiness because we were there ready to give her a bed. And as we started bringing in pieces of this bed, you can watch little Haley kind of figure it out, right? You know, and then, you know, once she realized what it was, she just erupted. I mean, she came and hugged us, complete strangers, you know, hugged the bed, even kissed the bed, which just melted my heart. And if that wasn't enough, you'd look up and here's mom, you know, 6 years of struggle and tears just pouring down her face. And I was raised by a single mom. So you want to talk about gut-wrenching. I knew what every single one of those tears meant. And right then I knew, okay, this is way more than just a bed that we're providing.
I am so grateful that you shared that story. And I heard you say, and what you shared with us about Haley and her family reminded me of something I heard you say, and that was, you really want joy? Stop looking at yourself and see how you can help someone else. That's right. Powerful, Luke. That's powerful.
Well, you know, at the time when all this was going on, or when it just started, I myself was going through kind of like a midlife crisis. I don't know, you know, as a faith crisis, it was identity. I didn't know. I was in a great job on paper. My life was great, right? I had nothing to complain about, which almost made it worse, because then I felt guilty. You know, I'm like, gosh, I should be happy. I'm coaching. I'm in church. You know, it should be extremely happy, but I wasn't. There was just something eating at me. And what I found out later, you know, was passion. I was just lacking passion. And when you find it, man, you just have to hold on to it. And that's just where I was. And I think a lot of people go through that. And when you see something like that and you experience it and then you feel it, you know, you can't look away anymore, you know?
No. And I want to circle back, because I love the story of how you got your children involved in volunteering. Mm. Tell us that first time your kids built beds for the first family and how it impacted your children.
You bet. So when we delivered that first bed, you know, it filled my heart. We had a great experience. I felt a little jealous because I didn't go on the delivery. There was two. Once the word got out that we had built this bed for this family, all the kids' parents wanted to be involved, all the leaders, you know, blah, blah, blah. So when they showed up to deliver, there was like 15, 20 people there. And I was like, you know what? I got to clean my garage. You know, it was cold. It was wintertime. So I stayed back and I felt pretty jealous about that. But, you know, it was a great experience. Well, life tends to creep back in, you know, and
it always does, right?
It always does. And I was feeling these feelings again. And, you know, it had only been a week later or so. And I remember sitting on the couch with my kids, and we were watching Big Bang Theory. That was our program at the time, you know, and a commercial came on, and it was a commercial about some Xbox game or a computer game. I don't remember, but I remember thinking, my kids are going to ask me if they want this game. And it was just a perfect storm of struggling internally, wishing I was making a difference. Here came this project. These kids didn't have any beds. And now my kids are complaining that they're not going to get an Xbox game. That, I mean, it just was like, as a parent, you know how it is. It's like, it just all fell on a single moment, a tiny moment. And I remember thinking, I can sit here and teach my kids, talk to them, share testimony, share pictures. I can do all this. Or I can get my butt off the couch and I can take them with me. And that's what I did. I stood up right in the middle of our program. I stood up and walked out to the garage, didn't say anything. And my kids are like, Dad, where are you going? And I turned around and I said, you know what? I got leftover wood. I'm going to build another bed, and you're coming with me.
And so that's great.
I have pictures of my little daughter in her pink tutu drilling screws, and my son in his Boise State jersey pounding away. I mean, we just had a great time, you know?
I really enjoyed the videos that you're a CNN hero. I saw that episode, and just the joy in your whole family, your wife, the kids, and now looking forward. Now, you could have named the organization really anything. And clearly you identified a problem in your community and communities across the country. Why Sleep in Heavenly Peace? Which I love, by the way, but how you got the title.
In fact, kind of a funny story real quick. I saw Rob Schneider in an airport lounge one time. And yeah, I was one of those guys. I went up to talk to him, and now we're good friends. I text him all the time. And he said, you know, Luke, it's funny. Your charity, Sleeping Heavenly Peace, sounds like a funeral home. I'm like, thanks, Rob. I appreciate that. No, what's funny is, so when we started building beds, right after that delivery with Haley, I was all in, right? I mean, I'm a farm kid from Idaho who loves hunting and fishing and college sports and all this stuff. And in a snap of a fingers, Sarah, that didn't mean anything anymore. It just did, you know, for the couple of hours each night that week that I spent building a bed to solve that problem, that was well worth my time, right? So we started building more beds. And the more we built, the more we delivered, the more we saw and shared and heard about these problems that these kids were having. Well, anyways, my wife said, well, you got to call this Christmas project something. And I said, don't worry. I've got the best name.
Yes. Yeah. Now I get it.
It was Christmas time, right? You know, we were getting ready for Christmas, and Silent Night is, you know, everybody's favorite hymn, it seems like. And, you know, Sleep in Heavenly Peace just, she said, how about Sleep in Heavenly Peace? And it just resonated exactly what we wanted these kids to feel and what we wanted to leave them with. And it's not too often when we deliver a bed, sometimes 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, these kids are in it and going to sleep. We get pictures from the moms a couple hours later. My kid's asleep. It's 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And it's because they've never had a bed before.
They didn't have a good night's sleep before.
They've never had some of them. I've been to a place where the kid never had a pillow, always slept on his shirt or his pants. So when they finally experience that, I mean, if you think about it, being, you know, in your early teens, laying your head down for the first time on something soft like a pillow, yeah, you're going to go to sleep.
It's making me feel really grateful about my pillow and my bed. Yeah. I always use the expression, I love bed. And so this is why it resonates with me so well. And from a medical standpoint, sleep is foundational to a child's development. Yeah. From your experience, what changes do families report once a child has their own bed? Like you shared that one example. I'd love to hear more.
Great, great question. We've done some surveys of pre and post deliveries, 60, 90 days out. And the statistics are phenomenal, right? The impact is phenomenal. And again, it's a lot more than just a good night's sleep. But if you just focus on the physical good night's sleep, I mean, there's studies that associate poor sleep with poor development, slow development in learning. So here you got a kid that not only shows up to school tired, mm-hmm. not ready to learn, that's for sure, has a hard time with mood and behavior because they're tired. All of us are that way. I mean, when you don't get a good night's sleep, you're terrible to be around at work, you know? And so here are these kids, they're already behind the curve with being able to learn. Their behaviors, and which affects them socially as well, you know, these are all effects of even just a poor night's sleep. And then you take the social aspect of, hey, these kids they're embarrassed. They don't have sleepover. They don't want someone to come in to their house and see their room. You know, the parents are embarrassed. Oftentimes these kids are sharing rooms and even beds with multiple siblings. And so, you know, they miss out on some of that aspect. And then you go to the mental part of things. And the best way I broadcast or share this is I had a friend of mine say, you know, Luke, it's interesting that you call your nonprofit, the acronym is SHP, right?
SHP.
Yeah. And I said, why is that? He says, because me and my sister, they grew up in kind of a rough home, you know, rough parent upbringing. And he said, when we had a bad day, me and my sister would always say, we're going to our secret hiding place. And it was their bed. And, you know, it really made me think. I mean, think about it. When you and I have a bad day or a hard day or we're sick or whatnot, where do we go? Where is one spot that we want to go to? Maybe after the bathtub. It's always our bed. You know, it's our sanctuary. It's our place to escape and be ourselves. And, you know, these kids don't. They don't have that. That's difficult as an adult. That's difficult, especially when you know you can do something about it. It's difficult to swallow. And all you can do, at least for me, all I can do is think about how quick can we get to these kids? How can we find them? How can we, change their life? Even if it's just for a little bit, change their life with something as simple and profound, though, as a bed.
Before we continue, if this conversation resonates with you, please like, share, and subscribe. It helps these stories reach more families and communities who need them. Stay with us, because coming up, we'll talk about how you at home can make a real difference right where you live, no matter what your community looks like. Yeah, so you show having a bed intersects with a child's sense of dignity, safety, belonging, you know, that those sleepovers, I didn't even consider that.
Yeah.
And you're seeing differences in a child's behavior, their school engagement, their emotional regulation. So I'm thrilled that you're getting that feedback. And Many people assume bedlessness is rare, only happens in extreme poverty. What misconceptions do you encounter most often?
Oh, thanks for asking that question, because when I tell people what I did, and this has been going on for 14 years now, when I tell people what I do, right, there are usually two questions pop up or two responses. The first one is, well, yeah, but it's not that big of a deal. There's not that many kids sleeping on the floor. And I tell them, look, I understand. I thought the same thing. There are no national statistics about child bedlessness.
No.
Because they don't know to take some. The only statistic that I know of is really what Sleep at Heavenly Peace has come up with over the last 14 years. And we're no statisticians, keep in mind. But by simply population, the number of applications we get, some of these variables we look at, we estimate that child bedlessness represents greater than 3% of the given population anywhere.
Wow. So
if you're in a town of 100,000 people, on average anyways, there's 3,000 kids that don't have a bed to sleep in. And, you know, I'm from a small town, Twin Falls, Idaho. We've got about, I don't know, with the neighboring community, maybe 60, 70,000 people. We've been here for 14 years. We still get an application two or three times a week. And we've delivered thousands of beds in our location. It's just a problem that doesn't go away, you know, and one that is desperately needed.
I remember learning that you started, I think it was like 11 beds. In 2012, there were 11 beds. So how many again since then?
We did 11 bunk beds. So it was 10 and a half. So it was 21 beds that first season. But we just celebrated our numbers in 2025, right? Mm-hmm. Just last year, we almost built this close, just shy of 90,000 beds.
Hello, that's amazing. That's amazing.
Well, we've got 430 plus chapters. We're in 47 states and four different countries. And if that doesn't represent how big the need is, this will. We actually, with all the 90,000 beds we built last year, the 350 plus that we've built since 2018, we still, and I should say, and the 1.2 million applications that we've received, right? We still only cover 27% of the United States. If that doesn't tell you how big this problem really is, and for you listeners at home sitting there thinking, really? Like, I know it's a shock. It's a shock to everybody.
It is.
When you find out how bad child bedlessness, it's not even a real word, but it's a real problem. And when you find out about it, I always encourage everybody, go find out for yourself. Go talk to first responders. Go talk to school counselors and anybody in the school district. These situations are very real.
They are. And you've built this volunteer-based organization into such an amazing movement. Tell us about the different chapters of Sleep in Heavenly Peace that have popped up around the country and how others and even pediatric healthcare providers can learn more about this and really get more involved.
Absolutely. So when we started, you know, delivering more and more friends of ours, I say ours, my good buddy Jordan, he jumped right on board with me back in the beginning. Well, we started two chapters, the Twin Falls chapter and the Boise chapter, right? We didn't know what that meant, but sure, that's what we're going to do. Well, then we had a lot of friends from other towns or even other states that wanted to do what we're doing. So we called them chapters. And when we became a nonprofit, we just continued that name. Well, as you know, in 2018, we were featured on Mike Rowe's Returning the Favor. You know, Mike Rowe's Dirty Jobs. Who doesn't love that guy?
It was a great episode. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend people watching
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. And it was viewed by 10 million people. Well, that was the megaphone that happened and that we needed. We went from the small, at that time, we had six or seven chapters in the beginning of 2018, to now we're at 430. And the reason why we did that, and the reason why that's important, Sarah, is because I knew simply because of volume and the, you know, my time as well, but obviously the volume and the circumstances that these kids were sleeping in, this problem wasn't going to be solved by some farm kid from Idaho. You know, we knew it was a local problem. It had to be solved by local people. So the only way we're going to do that is if we created a platform that was simple easy to enter. You know, the barrier to entry was small and easy and inexpensive, you know, as possible. And so a lot of things went into that, you know, keeping the mission as pure and transparent and simple as possible, right? Making sure that, you know, we source and work with and take away any of those problems of starting a chapter. So we did all that. And because of that, now our chapters, they operate pretty independently. I mean, they operate within the bounds of our organization and, you know, beds. The bed is the exact same as built in Alaska as it is in Hawaii, you know?
That's cool.
And the process is virtually the same. But anybody can start a chapter if they're willing, wanting, it's just tugs at their heart. They just have to go to shpbeds.org and it's all there. And the unique thing about our webpage is when you go to shpbeds.org, you're not going to come up to some big national main page. We have that, but that's not what first pops up. What pops up is the chapter that's closest to you, because we want the community to know that this problem, how big it is in your own hometown. Keeping in mind, there's probably only about 30% that even know about it. You know, so when you look and open up your web browser and click on shpbeds.org and you see that your local chapter has 200 kids on the waiting list, just know it's way more than that.
Wow. And with over 400 chapters, what have you learned about what makes local communities step up and sustain this work?
Ooh, that's a great question. You know, we received over 5,000 chapter requests when Returning the Favor hit that first year. 5,000.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
But we only
and overwhelming.
way overwhelming. But we only had about 200 show up. And the reason why that is because a lot of people, they hear it and they want to get inspired. They want to start a chapter. Well, really, they're probably more of a volunteer, right? Because becoming a chapter president, there's some work involved, right? You know, it's not just showing up one day. You know, there's some reporting that needs to be done. And we do a whole weekend training in Utah. We fly people to Utah and do a big training for them because, you know, it's pretty complicated. And so we try to explain what a chapter president does to people way before they even get to that point. Because it's important. We want people to know what they get into. That's the reason why we have less than 3% attrition when it comes to chapters starting and stopping. So it's we're very successful that way. You know, but I think chapter presidents are supported by their community, right? So usually it takes one individual that wants to stand up and really take this on. Oftentimes it's a retiree, but not all the time. And they stand up, they get a couple of friends that are all behind him, and they dive in. And I tell you what, the chapter that understands that you get the community involved, you become, you know, the bed builders, if you will, that's where the rubber meets the road. These community members, and that's really how we've grown. We haven't proselyted for new chapters. It's all organic. You know, a chapter starts in one city, then the next city overhears about it. Someone comes to a bill, then they go back and they start a chapter, and it just kind of, you know, blossoms from there. And so the unique thing I think I've found to answer your question is so the success of a chapter depends on the ability of the chapter president and the core team member to get their community involved.
And this sounds like what you often say, humans helping humans. From your perspective, does community service function as almost like a form of preventative medicine? And how do you see volunteering impacting mental health and giving a sense of purpose to adults and teens who are building these beds? I mean, I'm getting chills just thinking about
it. Great questions. Holy cow. You know, I actually do a lot of nonprofit training and consulting because, you know, a lot of nonprofits now are like, how'd you get from point A to point B? You know,
right.
At first, I'm like, I don't know, luck. I'm a farm kid from Idaho, right? But no, then, you know, I hear them and you hear what they do and how they solve problems. And I learned that we were doing some things right. One of which is, and nonprofits listen, you know, the biggest advantage we have is including the community and bringing them along. And I'll give you a quick story if you don't mind. It's my Hank story. So when we finally got this rundown, if you saw Returning the Favor, it was the warehouse that we were in, right? A rundown warehouse. It was my sanctuary. I loved it. And I did my very first build out of it in the middle of winter, January, I think. It was like 17 degrees outside. It was on a Saturday. And I didn't think I was going to get a lot of volunteers. So I posted in like the local newspaper, hey, we're doing a build. Anybody want to come down? Come down. Well, in walks Hank. And Hank's like this 200-year-old guy. I mean,
I'm picturing
weird.
Hank right now.
Oh, yeah. He's walking over. They know what was unique about him. I mean, he had this smile on his face that just lit you up, like a grandpa smile. I don't know how to express it. But he was handing out these little cards to all the other volunteers there. And it said, thank you for volunteering. So that told me that this wasn't Hank's first rodeo in volunteering at an event, right? Plus, I didn't know him from Adam. He just saw the newspaper and showed up, right? Well, Hank walks up to me and he says, okay, where do you need me? And my first thought was like, well, I don't want you to die. So it's quite the easiest thing for you. And I said, well, tell you what did you do for a living, Hank? And he's like, well, I was a carpenter for like 40 years. And I'm like, I know where to put you. Because if there's one thing in dealing with wood that you can't make a mistake on, and that's cutting it wrong. So I took him back to the cut station, and I showed him the cuts that we needed and blah, 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 and then sent him to work. Well, when you're at a build and you're responsible, you're the chapter president, and you're running around, you got 60 volunteers that have never done this before, right? Some of them have never touched a tool in their life.
That would be me.
You teach them, right? And it's even though it's super easy, you're still running around. Well, 4 hours go by, Sarah, and I forgot about Hank. I felt really bad, right?
So is he still alive? Like, what's going on?
Oh, trust me. I was like worried. The build was winding down, and I ran back, and there was Hank, right? And his clothes were as white as his hair, just covered in sawdust. And I was like, Hank, I am so sorry. I forgot. I got busy, blah, blah, blah. And Hank looked up at me and he says, you know, Lou, he's like, I've volunteered at a lot of places, right? But never have I shown up. And in 5 minutes, you put me on an assignment, right? And I couldn't leave. I couldn't go to the bathroom. I couldn't get a glass of water. I couldn't leave. And my first thought was like, oh my gosh, I know. I'm so sorry, Hank. And he said, no. He said, no, thank you. And it kind of took me back. And I thought, thank you. What do you mean? And it dawns on me, and we have a saying at Sleep and Emily Peace, the happiest volunteer is the sweatiest and the dustiest, right? And to answer your question, because when people want to volunteer, and this is why people love working with Sleep and Emily Peace, is because it's not easy work. And I used to think that was the bad thing, but no, it's actually the opposite. People, when you want to volunteer, they want to show up and feel like they made a difference.
Yes.
You're not going to feel like you made a difference if you're just pushing a broom around or punching a button. You're going to feel like you made a difference when you actually feel like you've sweated and you're sore and you remember it. Kind of like a workout, right? You know you worked your muscles when they're sore. Well, volunteering is no different. And with Sleep and Emily Peace, we have, I think last year alone, 560,000 volunteer hours, right? Just
wow. Awesome
amount of volunteers. And we love that because we know each one of those volunteers, they now have a story of their own, a story that they're going to be able to tell that is twofold. There is a problem called child bedlessness, and I know how to solve it. And I was a part of solving that. And my fingerprints are on every single one of those pieces of wood. Hank touched every single piece of wood that went through for those 20 beds that we built, right? And now he knows, he gets to go to bed at night knowing that his fingerprints and his sweat are on each one of those boards that went to those 20 beds and those 20 kids. And so, you know, it's a great question. I think internally, we all want to feel like we're making a difference. We all want to be a part of something, right? And that's what I found out long time ago. There's millions of people that are like that. They just don't know how. They don't know where, right? They want to be involved. They don't want to just sit in the sidelines. They want to get in the game. They want to struggle and they want to build and they want to push themselves. And that's what we provide. Our build process is not.
Those build days,
they're not efficient. They're not as streamlined as they possibly can be. Don't get me wrong. We know how to build beds, but we don't build them the most efficient way because it would eliminate volunteers. And that's the last thing we want to do.
Yes, I love that story, and I'm definitely going to be thinking about Hank, and I was thinking about it when you were telling me that story, that just what you said, that his hand is actually physically on each of the pieces of wood that he worked with.
That's right.
What keeps you hopeful after seeing so much unmet need firsthand and keeping that ripple effect of sleep and heavenly peace going?
That's an easy one. What I'm hopeful for, what brings hope and joy to my heart, is seeing all of our chapter presidents and people, new people every year. In fact, I'm going to training next week where we have the biggest training we've had for 4 or 5 years. We got 30 chapters that are showing up to this one training. I mean, can you imagine? And that's why I have a lot of hope, is because this started, it started with some farm kid from Idaho, but it has now grown, not because of him per se, but because there are millions of amazing people that, like I said, and you quoted me, you know, if you want true joy, you just got to stop looking at yourself and see how you can help other people's. Your problems don't go away. Of course they don't. But I promise you, they will not feel near as heavy. And that's what you find with all of our chapter presidents. These are men and women from all walks of life that really just want to give back. And it still just blows me away. It's inspiring to hear their stories and to see them shed a tear. Often, many times, it's people that grew up without a bed. They've experienced them themselves, right? That's the hope. It's almost no longer hope. It's just knowledge now that these people, this train is not going to stop because we have so many great people that want to help.
Luke, thank you for coming on and sharing and inspiring us with what you and your organization are doing. We at Growing Up with Dr. Sarah hope people are looking for opportunities to help this community and will follow you at Sleep in Heavenly Peace.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. And it's been such a pleasure. Luke's story reminds us that meaningful change often begins with noticing what's right in front of us and choosing to act with compassion. When we meet children's most basic needs, we don't just improve their sleep, we strengthen their sense of safety, dignity, and possibility. I'm Dr. Sarah, and thanks for listening, and let's grow up together.
Also feeling like you're still growing up yourself? Do you wonder if you are getting it right? Welcome to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah. She's a pediatrician and a mom, and she helps the whole family.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sarah Adams, a board-certified pediatrician, but I'm not your pediatrician. Feel free to use my podcast as helpful information, but in no way do I intend my podcast to replace the advice of your physician. Your physician knows you and is in the best position to provide medical advice.
Produced by AutoVita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.